so far the theorist and more the biophysicist in this collaboration. This is work with Dan Church from biochemistry. A lot of these ideas are, we hold them jointly, so we work very closely together. Our team, William Ziley is a research scientist who does a lot of experimental work. Joe Phillips is a postdoc. And these are the three graduate students from chemical engineering, Luzelina Cabo-Caro, Colin Stern, and Kimberly Inoligi. And most of them actually work on different experimental aspects of our overall project, but I'm going to talk mostly about just theory today. Okay, so the overview of my presentation, I want to give some background on actin-based propulsion of intracellular particles, talk about this idea of filament in-tracking motors, which is a new idea we put in the literature, and it's semi-controversial, I guess. Some people don't believe they exist, or some people do. Not just us, so that's good. Reaction diffusion model for particle propulsion. And the idea here is to do modeling to take the properties that are predicted by the molecular mechanism for active filament growth in these filament interacting motors and to see how well they predict behavior on a more, I won't say macroscopic, but on a cell scale or bacterial scale. Okay, so Jim gave a nice overview before on this, but actin is a 42 kilodalton protein. It can bind either ATP or ADP, and when it assembles into a filament, it forms a stiff worm-like chain. And just some of the dimensions that are relevant: the diameter is about 7 nanometers. The periodicity of each of the two subfilaments, they form two subfilaments that wrap around themselves helically, is about 5.4 nanometers, and so every time you add a new subunit, it adds about 2.7 nanometers to the length of the filament. The filament's polarized, so there's a plus end and a minus end in the assembly. If you just assemble the filament in solution, it'll self-assemble with ATP and actin binding here, hydrolysis occurring somewhere on the filament length, and then disassembly occurring over here somewhere. It's a fairly stiff filament, so the persistence length is much longer than the length scale. You see here, it's about 10 microns. Okay, so a key question, a major question in cell biology for a long time has been how do cells actually polymerize actin to crawl? How is polymerization generating a force? And this is very complicated by the fact that not only does the cell have to polymerize the actin, but it can form various structures in doing so. So a lamella might have a more branch-like structure shown here. A filipod will be more a parallel bundle of filaments. But the general question is how do cells rapidly polymerize actin where they want it, and how does this polymerization actually generate force? So the second is more of a biophysical question. And it's not just relevant to cell crawling, there's a lot of other processes, cell protrusions in crawling, phagocytosis, intracellular vesicle transport, as we'll see in a minute, the formation of synapses, adhesion, cell division, all these different processes involved the control of polymerization of actin. And so the process that we're mostly going to focus on is the intracellular propulsion of pathogens, such as Listeria monocytogenes. Various bacteria and viruses, as you know, can gain access to the interior of a cell. It's essentially the bacteria stimulate the engulfment, and Listeria's case, it secretes an enzyme called Listeria lysin, which can break the membrane container, bag around it, and escape into the cytoplasm, where it'll grow and divide and feed off the various nutrients in the cytoplasm. But eventually the cell will start to undergo apoptosis, and so in the life strategy, the bacteria needs to escape to another cell before that happens. And so the way it does that, I'll just play that in the beginning so you can see, this is 500-fold faster in real time. And you can see the bacteria swim. They're not swimming, they're actually propelling themselves back in polymerization, and sometimes they'll come to the membrane. If there was a neighboring cell, then it can just penetrate the two membranes and go into the neighboring cell. This is a micrograph. I neglect to put the reference here, but this is from also Jewish materials lab and Gary Borsi in a paper from in Current Biology 2001. This is a Listeria bacteria. You can get a good idea of the length scale. It's about 400 to here's the pole of bacteria, which has a protein called ACTA, which is the essential component for propulsion in a cell or in a cell extract. So ACTA is sufficient for the bacterium to capture the host cell's proteins to begin this process.
So if that length scale is about 400, 500 nanometers, why is the filament so jumbo like spaghetti if the stiffness is?
Two reasons. One is that they're under mechanical forces that'll change it. And the second reason is that I believe in the processing, this is kind of a controversial point. I saw Gary Borsi on the list. I don't know if he's here. Is he here? Okay, and maybe you can answer that point. But it's not clear whether the structure you see in the filaments, the bending and whatnot, is a representation of what's actually occurring. There could be in the preparation of the sample, there could be some additional bending and whatnot. Any other questions on this? Okay. So in fact, if you take ACTA, you can coat it. Even that by adsorption or covalent coating on beads or vesicles or various inert particles, and put them in a cell extract, and also undergo active-based motility. And also in a cocktail of reconstituted components, as shown by Marie Carlier's lab, this can also occur. So here, this is the paper I was just referring to. This is a 500 nanometer bead. Here's the tail that's left behind, so you can see this fairly dense network of filaments. You also see some filaments that sort of grow off in the wrong angle, but most of them are left behind this filament. So this is actually a very stiff, it's an elastic material, and Cecil cites, and there's a paper that came out in 99 or something, actually measured the elastic modulus, and it's on the order of about 10 kilopascals, plus or minus a lot. So what is essential for propulsion? Okay, obviously you have to have actin to form the filaments. And usually in the cell, this will come in the form of propylene actin. You have to have some way to bind the filaments together by a cross-linking protein such as alpha-actinin. And otherwise, with polymerization, they'll just end up with free filaments in many cases. And you also need to have some surface components. And in this case, ACTA binds to another protein called VASP, which is short for vasodilator-stimulated phosphoprotein. And this complex, we believe, is critical to the polymerization. Okay, so ACTA also nucleates filaments by binding another protein complex called RF23 complex in solution to form the new filament. Okay, but the nucleation itself is not essential for the propulsion. You can actually separate the two steps, form filaments, inhibit the nucleation of new filaments, and the bacterium still can continue on its way. Okay, it's not just ACTA, it's not just Listeria, there's lots of other organisms, microorganisms that do this. Here's Shigella flexneri. It has a protein on its surface called VJA, which binds to N-WASP, and N-WASP is another critical protein component that we're going to talk about a lot. And that's what you see here in green, and here's the actin tail left behind. Okay, vertical derrier, pseudomali, or not pronounce it, I apologize. Has a protein on its surface, the transmembrane protein called MA, which has a structure very similar to WASP, or in WASP. WASP is short for Wiskotch-Aldrich syndrome protein, and in WASP is neuronal fat. Okay, another bacterium called the Rickettsia. You can see the filaments that are created here. It's pretty clear in the structure here. Actually, the different bacteria will make a little bit different. They'll make different structures sometimes, and even in different conditions, the structure of the tail will look a little bit different. In the case of Rickettsia, they tend to make these sort of individual filaments, and you can see them terminating here on the surface of the bacterium. So RIC-A is the protein on Rickettsia, which is also similar to WASP and N-WASP. Finally, vesicles, bacteria, are viruses, such as vaccinia virus and even smallpox virus, variola major is the proper name for it, can spread, be propelled inside of cells by this mechanism. But in this case, it's enclosed with the vesicle, but the vesicle has a protein called NICK, N-C-K, which binds to N-WASP. And also platinum-coated endocytic vesicles can also be propelled. So this is a sort of a clear what the linking molecule was is in this process, but it may be Nick also binds DN wasp on the surface and phagosomes as well. Okay, so many different types of particles one are doing this method.
Okay, so Nick is actually a normal protein that you find in mammalian cells.
That's correct. Yeah. So the actual signaling process is still sort of an area of active investigation, but basically, in the signaling process, Nick is localized to the membrane and then binds in wasp there. And then in wasp, Nick lets a new filament. And finally, a lot of work, important work, has been done on looking at particles in vitro in biomimetic systems. And here's some important examples. So this is from Alex Van Udenaar's group at MIT. And here's a phospholipid vesicle with the actin tail moving behind it, or extending behind it. And in this work, they analyzed, much like another group that came out about the same time, Julia Kuro's lab, analyzed the deformation of vesicles undergoing actin base motility to estimate what the stresses are on the surface. And a similar type of approach, here's an oil droplet coated with a BCA peptide, which is, well, I'm sorry, I should mention, this is coated with ACTA in an extract. This is coated with the BCA peptide, which comes from NWASP. In this case, it was a reconstituted cocktail of proteins for motility. Here is a BCA-coated particle as well. And this is a polystyrene microsphere. And this pattern here is something we're going to talk about later, as well as the deformation. And this is from Jim McGrath, looking at actually hard particles, which answered an important question whether curvature is necessary for propulsion. And I think the answer from his work was that it's not, and that's something that we agree with.
When they cook these particles, is it uniformly distributed, or do you put more on one hemisphere than the other?
Well, it depends. In the case of a hard particle, it depends on the kidney conditions whether it's going to be modal. It depends on what the surface molecule is. Because what happens is, in the case of active ASC, for example, if the particle is too large, and we'll get the mechanism in a minute, that it forms a nice shell of or a gel of actin around the particle, but it will never break symmetry in such a way that it can start to move off in a different direction. But in the case of a soft particle, that's less of an issue because it's a fluid membrane and the filament ends are free to translate. So the linkage between the growing filament and the surface is a critical point of the whole work here. But in the case here, this was started uniformly coated, for example, with the VCA, but it ends up co-localizing with the filaments. Okay, so how do filaments actually generate force when they're polymerizing? And this is, I guess you can call it the conventional view that people have held for some time. That is, if you have a free filament end in a surface, and there may be a load resisting the motion of the free filament end, ATP actin will bind. This is a little cartoon. Proteins don't look like this. This is just for illustrative purposes. The chevron represents the barbed end, the minus end. And so what this fluctuating position of the surface, it actually, the filament could be fluctuating too, but basically the idea is that these fluctuations allow new subunits to add to the end of the filament. Okay? And as they add, the filament has gained a certain length. And so the filament can actually do work in this manner. Okay? But of course it can't do any more work than the energy change upon adding a filament. So if there's a certain binding energy by binding this filament here, and it, because of the monomer concentration, the solution is of ATP actin by itself, unsequestered, is fairly low. That energy is actually not very high. It's only about 1 kT for every bound subunit. Okay, and the other property of a thermal ratchet like this, okay, so the fluctuations, if you load it, then kinetically it's expected to decrease exponentially as a function of load. So it should, and because of that, it should be sensitive to piconewton or below forces, very force sensitive. Okay, and for it to work at all, there has to be, the filament end has to be free to allow these fluctuations to open up a space to insert new subunits. And so the idea that this is essentially two different basic mechanisms, and I'll show you the other one in a second that'll work this way. The idea that we put forward in 2002 was that, well, filaments, instead of being free, and we had a lot of evidence at the time that suggested this, the filaments actually grow while persistently associated with the surface, so they grow processively. So, and I'll show you in this cartoon how that could work. This doesn't represent an alpha helix or anything like that. This just represents the molecule has some flexibility represented by the springs. So if you can, hopefully this will replay. Okay, so what's happening in this version of the mechanism? So here's the prophylactin. It's being captured out of solution, and then it's being transferred into that subfilament. And when that binds, that triggers the hydrolysis on the opposite subfilament, and the energy of ATP, this hydrolysis that's released, goes to attenuate the affinity and release that other arm. So it's a ratcheting mechanism. So got one arm tightly bound, grab another subunit out of solution, transfer it in, that causes this one to release. And it just goes over and over. Okay, and so the properties of this are that it's processive, so it elongates without releasing. Because it can capture the ATP hydrolysis here, the hydrolysis occurs anywhere down the filament. It's not coupled to the elongation. Here, the hydrolysis is coupled to the elongation. It actually does some work by releasing that protein-protein bond. And there's about 14 kT of energy available from hydrolysis that could potentially be used for that, compared to the 1 kT up here. Sorry, I'm missing a beat. 1 kT, but it's the same kT. Okay. And other properties that it has, as you can imagine, if I have a lot of monomer, then it'll start to saturate with respect to monomer because it'll bind up these sites. It, as we'll see in a minute too, it's insensitive to force because the slow step of binding in principle should be force insensitive because it just has to capture a monomer. Okay, the force sensitive step will be the transfer of that subunit to the end of the filament, and because that only requires a local molecular motion, in principle that should be much faster. Okay, the slow process is actually capturing the subunit. Okay, so it anticipates that there should be a force and sensitivity up to a point where you start to slow the transfer step. Okay? I'll show you that graphically here in a minute. And the other property, which I'm not going to talk about, but it's also relevant, is that by having this thing operating on the end of a filament, it could protect it from capping protein. And it's been well known for some time that in vivo, that the elongation or the propulsion of Listeria is insensitive to the concentration of capping protein. And there's other evidence for that in general as well. Okay, it doesn't have to work that way, of course. And there's one can devise other schemes. And in fact, the real situation may be some combination of these. But it's too early to know that. But I'll talk to structural evidence here in a minute. So here's actually a little bit simpler idea, and this is more similar to our first paper. Here, the two subunits are bound tightly to the ATP. In this case, an ATP-bound subunit just slips in here. That triggers the hydrolysis of the penultimate subunit, causes it to release, so some amount of energy of the 14 kT available, if it represents the binding interactions as these potential energy wells, it attenuates that binding energy. Okay, so it puts it in this state, and now it can release, and it'll drop into this well, which brings it back to the initial state. So here it's just a new subunit comes in, causes it to release in advance. But it also was able to capture some of the energy so that the net thermodynamic driving force for the polymerization is increased. Okay. And here, this is essentially the first one I showed you, but without the role of profile. But we believe, at least in the systems that we're interested in WASP and VASP and Forman's, profile in some cases is clearly essential part of the apparatus. Okay, so here's our cartoon picture. And here's another cartoon picture, but maybe with a little bit more detail, just to show you what the essential parts of it are in all of these different proteins. So there's a surface, or in the case of in WASP and VASP, There's a surface tethering domain called EVH1. Okay, there's also there's a procholine binding domain, proline-rich procholine binding domain, and then there's a monomer or filament binding domain as well. Okay? And there's a lot of similarity between VASP and WASP in its structure. Here's the EVH1 here, EVH1 here. Here's the procholine binding domain. Here's the, it's called the WH2 in WASP. It's called GAB in VASP, but there's a lot of structural sequence and structural similarity here as well. And here is a second a monomer binding domain here called C in WASP and FAB in VASP. This is actually from Roberto Dominguez's lab. He just published a paper making the structural case for much of what I'm going to tell you today, arguing that they're based on the proximity of the different domains. Here's the procholine binding domain. Here's the WH2 domain. This is procholine actin. Okay, that is perfectly plausible that it could be served to transfer that subunit into the end of the filament. And it's also known that WH2 is sensitive to the ATP or the hydrolysis state of the subunit. Okay, so this was back when we first came up with the idea. There was no structural evidence really at all that we could draw upon, but now there's a fairly good case, and that may hopefully continue. And here's this WASP-like from Rickettsia. You can see the proline-rich procholine binding domain. This W is the same as this one here. C is the same as this one. And so it has essentially all the same components. Okay, and here's formins. Formins is a different molecule, and there's no question now that it's operating processively on the end of the filament. Nobody disputes this anymore. But again, when we first came up with the idea for we were working VASP, and people did not have this picture in mind for formins at that time. And here's the different key domains of VASP. There's a surface tethering domain which binds to membrane proteins, activated membrane proteins, or not just membrane, but wherever the object is that needs to be pushed are located. There's a proline-rich binding domain, and there's also the filament binding domain. Okay, and this paper actually came out after our second paper on this topic, which talked about these different mechanisms and proposed this role for profilin, which would explain the critical role of profilin in the affinity modulation process. Well, it turns out that at the same time that we were working on our theory, and presumably independent, but hopefully you never know for sure. But in any event, they were examining the formins, and they found that the hydrolysis rate was coupled to the elongation rate, which suggested, and also found a higher thermodynamic driving force for assembly in the presence of procholine actin by formins, and they proposed this mechanism, which is identical to the one that we proposed. It's essentially identical, except, and it's kind of hidden here, we believe for this to actually work, there has to be some interaction between both of the two terminal subfilaments rather than just the one, because it's hard to imagine how this would be processive if this bond should be fairly easy to break. But that's really the only essential difference. And importantly, here's a formin-coated bead. It forms rocket tails just like the others. And yet, people in the community think that WASP and VASP or ENACT-A are doing something totally different than what formins are doing. But we've argued that they're the same, essentially.
So the one thing about formins is the symmetry right there. It's a dimer, and that sort of helps with the idea that you're processively tracking the end. Are you saying that the VASP would...
VASP is a tetramer, actually. And in WASP, it is, as far as I know, is not, but it only works if it's bound to components that have three so-called SH3 domains, which are the sarcomology domain threes. And that would impart this tetrameric, tetrameric behavior. But in these biomimetic systems, the fact that it's bound to a surface, if the density is high enough, that in itself will give it its multivalent property. So, in the theory, definitely the multivalency is an important part of it. Unless somehow this advancement can be achieved without having the two filaments operated on in a similar fashion.
You gotta let go in that case. That's
yeah.
The problem, right?
free barb ends, which also are important. So, and when we get to the rates, this will be important because when you form new barbed ends, essentially you're forming sinks for monomer, and it slows down the process. Unless those are actually, well, even if they are doing something on the surface. So, and there's some good evidence for that as well. So if I add cofillin, if it's acting as a capping agent, then it can reduce the number of ends that are not doing anything useful. Okay, and just to show, to bring it back to the cell migration, this is VASP, B16 murine melanoma cell, I believe. And you can see what it's light lit up here wherever the cell is forming protrusions. Yeah, this varies from different cell types. It may not be, the VASP isn't so prominent in all cell types. But this is a neurite, and here's these green dots are the VASP at the tips of these filopodi. Okay, and just to show that the idea isn't necessarily just only an active polymerization, but it may apply elsewhere. Here's PAR-M, which many of you may know is a bacterial prokaryotic form of actin. It's essentially very similar to actin. It forms similar filaments, has similar structure. But in the cell division and the division and the segregation of the two chromosomes of E. coli, this involves a what's argued to be a motor operated by this mechanism. So when this paper came out very shortly after our first paper, and the authors cited our proposed mechanism as a possible way that this actually occurs. So here, same idea. This protein PAR-M links to the chromosome. As subunits insert, there's a process of elongation without ever releasing the chromosome. Okay, so that's sort of the biological case. Now I want to get to some of the propulsion and some of the theory. So what's going to limit the rate of propulsion? Okay, so there's, you can imagine different rate limiting effects. So there's the elongation of the filaments themselves is going to depend on how quickly monomers can actually get to the ends of the filaments, and then how quickly the cycle can complete once the monomer actually gets in there and binds. So if you can break the whole cycle down of the sequence into two steps, here's the part that's dependent on the concentration of monomer binding. So monomer binds. Here's the part that should be independent of the concentration. That's how long it takes for it to transfer and then the release. Okay, so I'll call this one RB, and then that minus one shouldn't be there, and this one will be RT. Okay, so if you just look at the maximum elongation rate, assume every step's irreversible for now, okay, what you'd expect to see is that at low concentrations, okay, this step should be rate limiting, and you should get a rate that's proportional to the concentration, and that's observed under low concentrations in actin-based motility. Under high concentrations, however, because this can saturate and this becomes rate limiting, then you'd expect it to be independent of concentration, and that's also observed. Okay. What about the force dependence? And we have a paper from the 2004 paper that we wrote on this topic. This is more qualitative than quantitative because we don't know all the parameters, but we can estimate roughly what they should be based on the length scales and whatnot. Okay, here is we can call the characteristic behavior of this type of cycle. Here, under low forces, it's independent of force because this step's rate limiting. Only under high forces, where you start to slow down this step, you start to kinetically hinder it. Okay? This is if the transfer step is rate limiting. This would be if the release step was force dependent. This would be if the release step. In either case, they cross here at a high force, depending on how much of that hydrolysis energy is actually captured for the elongation. Okay, this would be just a free filament re-elongating. Okay, this has less energy because it doesn't capture the hydrolysis energy, so it crosses here and also decays quickly because it's acting like a thermal reaction. Okay, and of course, it can't grow under tension, and so it doesn't support any tension whatsoever. So this behavior right here is important because it suggests that filaments that are operating in this manner, they'll grow under significant forces, and they'll also grow at the same rate while under tension. So you'll end up with this force balance between pushing filaments and filaments that are being, just happen to be behind for whatever reason, maybe stochastic, or there may be some spatial differences that we'll see.
Why do you say that a free filament can't support tension?
Because it's free. I mean, it's if you pull on it, it'll just come away from the surface, right? So it'd have to be bound in some way.
But I mean, really, it's attached to the network.
Right, but yeah, individually, I mean, yeah, you're right. That if it is also bound to the network, but I mean, if the whole there's nothing that if all the filaments are free, okay, you pull it away. There's nothing to support that tension unless there's some other type binding interactions. Okay, so the physical picture is something like this. And here's the filaments. Some of them are pushing. Some of them are being pulled by the faster filaments. Okay, so you end up with, you have tensile forces on the slower filaments, compressive forces on the filaments that happen to be faster. So you end up with a tight force balance like this between pushing and pulling filaments. Okay, so the implication then again is this force-independent elongation rate, you get the tight force balance. And also you'd expect that the speed of the elongation is going to be limited, rate limited, by how fast the slowest filaments can elongate. Can't go any faster unless they detach. If they detach, then they're not the slowest attached filament anymore, and then there's another filament. And so, if, especially in these biomimetic systems, if you pull on them hard enough, eventually the connection is going to come off. So this physical picture is different than what you may have seen in literature. That is, there's some propulsive force due to the elongation, and that's resisted by some friction, maybe hydrodynamic drag, maybe some passive bonds, but not elongated filaments. So one popular model is this tethered ratchet model, where the bonds that are—it's free filaments, but there's bonds as a new filament is created. There's a temporary bond between the RP23 complex and the ACTA that needs to be broken by the pushing filaments. Okay, so this is credited to Scott Kuo and Jim McGrath, who's here. So this is actually one of the papers that we were looking at when we were thinking that this is how the system must work. The two things that we were thinking about were the mechanical connection, but also that we believed that there had to be a monomer transfer mechanism from the surface. And what they found was that in the trajectories, there was a very small fluctuation. Actually, most of the fluctuation you see here was reported as the instrumentation fluctuations rather than actual fluctuations in the past. But the small fluctuation suggesting this force balance, but also there was a monomer-sized steps that showed up in the trajectory. And this was a puzzlement to many in the community, I'm sure. Jim can tell us about that. And we thinking about this, the explanation, if you think in terms of filaments growing while tethered, the explanation became pretty clear how this could happen. Because you have a population of filaments, if they're all growing the same way, the filaments that are under compression, because they're filaments, are going to behave kind of like springs, but have very low tensile stiffness or a low compressive stiffness. The filaments that are taut are going to behave like filaments, so they're going to have a higher tensile stiffness. So if you put a population like that, allow them to undergo a certain growth rule, which only starts to kinetically stall at high forces, what happens is it'll evolve to episodes where you'll have one filament that's limiting, even if you have 100 or 200 filaments that are pushing by the exact same growth rule. And what that leads to is monomer-sized steps as the filament elongates. Okay, and that's what we showed in the paper. So that was our first proposal for this mechanism, and that was one of the things we tested against. Another thing you'd expect to see, if this were true, in situations where the filament's growing processively, and if it's a gram-positive bacterium and the protein from which it's growing is not rotationally compliant, you'd expect a torque to be generated as the filament twists. Right? So the filament has a twist, so as it's elongating, it's going to generate a torque on the surface. So all the filaments that are growing on the surface are generating a torque. So that torque can be relieved if the surface twists. Okay, so what that results in, we believe, is formation of these superhelical tails. We see this and especially in brain extracts, these appear quite a bit. In brain extracts, the depolymerization is slow compared to other preparations.
I wonder about where you get double TMJ also.
We don't see those in Listeria. I know I've seen them in a paper. It may or may not be the same mechanism. I'm not sure. In this case, these are, I should mention, these are all right-handed helices. Yeah, in that case, I don't know if it's the same physical phenomenon. But in this case, these are right-handed, except for cases where we have seen a left-handed helix, but just it was following a right-handed helix where the trajectory folded back on itself, just like a telephone cord. You can turn from right to left. But and I should also mention that Julie Tiro's group, they reported just the rotation in an extract where the filament, the tail was much shorter, where they wouldn't see this type of structure, but they reported the rotation, but only for gram-positive bacteria, not for gram-negative bacteria, which you'd expect not to be rotationally compliant of the proteins in the membrane. I think they're using the IGSA on E. coli in that case for the gram-negative bacteria. So we took that as evidence of the same phenomena. And finally, experiments that I mentioned a minute ago, let me just give some more details. And this is focusing on Alex Van Oudenaarde's results. So based on the deformation of the vesicle, he estimated about 10 to 20 piconewtons per filament at the point which the vesicle would distend to a point, and then actually it would break its contact from the tail at the back and then peel off the tail and round up again. So in these observations, this periodic type motion would appear. So it would distend, peel off, round up, distend. And this is the trajectory from his paper. And this is the red circles are the front. Mm-hmm. It's fairly constant in time. The black circles are the back. And it appears that after you get this rounding phase, it's almost a constant velocity again. Okay, and then it peels and it's almost a constant velocity and feels almost a constant velocity. So basically, when it's not rounding up, the back appears to be just moving forward at a constant, nearly constant rate, but just a slower rate than the front. Okay, so that's an important thing that needs to be explained. And we think this idea of filaments growing while tethered can explain that. So what's causing the deformation? Well, our explanation is fairly simple, and that is it's just a diffusion limitation. Okay, and how can we argue for that? Well, if you estimate the reaction velocity, this is the forward binding rate of the subunits to the filament ends, either to the complex or the filament end itself. This is the density of filaments on the surface. Okay, this is the diffusivity of subunits through the tail, which is about 5 microns squared per second, estimated by Cecile Seitz. And this is the radius of the tail, which is the diffusion length over which monomers need to bind, a characteristic diffusion length, to actually cause the propulsion to occur. Okay, so this ratio in this system is about 5, okay, which means that the reaction velocity is significantly larger than the diffusion velocity, which means it should be diffusion limited. Another important number, we saw it in the last talk, or 2 talks ago, I guess, or this morning, sometime today, the Peclet number in this system, okay, the velocity is substantially slower, the convective velocity of the fluid, so fluid transport of any subunits is substantially smaller than the diffusive transport. And that makes the treatment a lot easier. Okay, so here are our best estimates of the parameters that appear in that equation. So what's the explanation? Well, the filaments, the propulsion is this way, so on average the filaments are growing in this direction. It starts at a round shape, it distends to this type of shape here. So if filaments on the outside have more monomers, a higher monomer concentration because of a diffusion gradient, that should explain this distension. And I can show you that more quantitatively here. Okay, so here's how we model that. Here's the surface. This can actually change shape as long as it's axisymmetric and taking the same approach. And here's the diffusivity in the tail. We assumed a higher diffusivity on the outside, and it doesn't really affect the results because the critical diffusion, the rate limiting diffusion occurs over this range, but we assumed a threefold higher factor, which is a reasonable estimate for a cell extract. And here's the boundary condition on the surface, just the first order consumption of monomer at the surface. Here's the density of filaments, ends at the surface. And we assume that because typically when you look at these, the filaments on the front are much more sparse. We just assume that there was no filaments on the front of the vesicle. Okay. And because we can assume it's at a quasi-steady state, everything changes slowly in time. The deformations are slow compared to all the other characteristic timescales. We just assume that the Laplace equation applies everywhere. And then we use the boundary element method to solve for that. Yeah.
Sorry, could you go back a second to your definition of a diffusion velocity? I'm a little bit confused about what it means to define a velocity for diffusion.
It's like the mass transfer coefficient to the surface, or it's this value times the concentration would be the flux if we were just reaction limited only, if diffusion were not limiting anymore.
Right. I mean, so normally when I think about diffusion, I think about the length, the time it takes to go a certain length going as the length squared, right? So if I were to say how long does it take to diffuse, a distance r, I would look at r squared over d. And I'm confused about how you get from that to something with the units of velocity without any square roots showing up. How are you doing this estimate of a velocity from a diffusive process?
Well, you can just, if you set up a problem like this. So if let's say you have a sphere that's perfectly perfect sink, okay, and you want to know what the flux of something to that sphere. Okay, that value would just be d over r times the concentration. Now, if you set up the opposite case where their diffusion is infinitely fast, but there's a first order reaction to a sphere, then it would just be kf times rho times c. So, with the characteristic diffusion length, though, would still be r in that type of thinking. Any other questions at this point? Okay, so solving this is a solution. So, first, here's this line here. First, just looking at the case where the diffusivity inside and outside the tail are the same, this line represents that case. Okay, this line represents where the outside is threefold higher. So you can see that especially where it's important is in the center, is not that greatly different by changing it, the diffusivity increasing threefold. This line, solid line, is the analytical solution. The dotted line is the numerical solution. So it just confirmed that we had a good solution. Here's what happens if you vary the radius. So if you make a smaller particle, here's 5 micron, 2 micron radius, 0.8 micron, 0.2 micron, so eventually the concentration becomes less depleted in the center of the tail. Okay? But you can see definitely, this is the case I should mention, where we assume that half the sphere was uniformly coated and the front half was void of filaments. Okay, but there's a concentration gradient that goes from the inside to the outside. And you can see that also here. Okay, so what we did then is if we just estimate the rate of elongation, okay, as the four rate constant times the concentration at the center, and just plot that as a function of radius, then we can, there's the data in the literature under known conditions, we just made a comparison to see how well that matched up. So if that was the limiting velocity, how fast the filaments can elongate in the center, actually for 30 nanometer spacing between filaments, which led to that value, is our best estimate before we started, appears to capture most of the data very nicely. Okay, there's some scatter in the data, but still, especially in this lower here region here where it should be diffusion limited, it does a pretty good job. And here's looking at a reasonable range of parameter values for the filaments, mean filament spacing, and it still captures it pretty well. So that gave us a lot of confidence that it was diffusion limited, and that it was limited by the velocity, the rate of elongation of the slowest filaments in the center. And now you can exceed the diffusion limit if you can reduce the filament number. And that's an important theme of this talk. And one way the filament number can be reduced is if the stress difference between the inside and the outside filaments builds up to the point where you actually rupture the bonds between the inside of the filaments, then the particle can move forward with fewer filaments and move faster. And that's what we believe is happening with this saltatory motion here that you see in a lot of these trajectories. Okay, so let's go back first to the soft particles. And so in this case, it's a little bit different because if the filaments are pointing this way on average, you actually, and the filaments are free to move in the membrane, you would actually not expect to have a uniformly coated surface on this side. The density would actually decrease as you get to the boundaries. This isn't a big deal in terms of the you don't get a lot of differences in the results, but that's what we actually assumed in the vesicle simulations that I'm going to show you in a second. But it also matches up nicely to where the ACT A appears on vesicles. It's found by the two different groups, and appears the VCA peptide on these oil drops. So it appears to co-localize, and if this represents, if this corresponds to the filament end density, then I think the assumption's a pretty good one. Okay, so here's the result there. You can see it's not greatly different. But that's, and this coloring, the light represents the density of filaments on the surface. Okay, so if you could just simulate over time, okay, what happens is the vesicle distends. Okay, here's an kind of Grignion vesicle mechanics, just moving the vesicle forward by the elongation. You end up getting a teardrop shape spontaneously. Okay, so the characteristic shape seen in these experiments and seen by different groups and explained by different complicated mechanisms about force-dependent growth can be entirely predicted just by accounting for the difference of diffusion.
Sorry,
no other.
Is that a 2D simulation or a section?
That's an axisymmetric simulation. Okay, but it doesn't capture the full dynamics because the full dynamics depend on the mechanics. So here's a snapshot, basically. So the idea is that, again, that the characteristic teardrop shape is predicted without any mechanical treatment whatsoever. Okay, but we'd like to see if we can take it a little bit further. So what we did is, in the original paper where the data appeared by Van Uytenaerden, they actually did a nice job modeling the membrane for the mechanics of the vesicle, accounting for the osmotic pressure and the membrane tension. I'm not going to go through the equations, but I'll just show you what we accounted for. We accounted for the same model that they had here, but also we accounted for the membrane bending stress as well, mostly for numerical reasons to keep it smooth at the point here. Initially, we just assumed the actin network was rigid, but then we also wanted to see what the effect of the compliance was. So we also accounted for the elastic deformation of this cup as the stresses build up on the side here. We allowed for elastic deformation of the cuff as well. And then finally, in the rounding phase, we accounted for, it's not essential to the overall model, but as it rounds, there has to be something that's rate limiting how fast it's going to round. So it could be how fast it peels the bonds, or it could simply be how fast can water flow back in across the membrane. And that's what we assumed, and it seemed to capture pretty nicely. So what happens is this thing distends, it eventually reaches a stress here, a critical stress, where the bonds rupture, which is the critical stress is some characteristic bond force, which we took as 10 piconewtons times the density of filaments at the center of the tail. So at that point, the vesicle will, a contact line will form, the vesicle will then peel away from the surface and round up again, and then the process will start over. So let me just show you a result of all that. Okay, so the color, this is the color, or the gray level represents the concentration. The lines represent the stresses. So there's a compressive stress on the sides and tensile stress on the outside. And you can see the oscillations. Okay, so in this simulation, we take everything the same except what we assume the thermal ratchet type kinetics where it's force sensitive. And just an exponential dependence on force. And you can see that the stresses never build up to anything close to what would be needed to actually cause it to round up or even distend significantly. There is a little bit of a deformation there, but not much. Yeah?
But in this simulation, do you have active network elasticity at all?
That's right. That's what that you can actually see the deformation. But it turns out, in this is 50 kilopascals. You see the wavelength, I'll take it, the distance between rounding phases, asymptotically approaches a constant value at I'll show you that plot here in a second. So it's essentially acting like a rigid network in this one, but here it deforms. No, in the one I'll show you in a second, it deforms. You see what happens.
So you treat it as an elastic continuum?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, as a first rule.
Why don't the outside filaments run away and just once the rupture happens, something has to slow it down?
Yeah, what happened? We don't treat that explicitly in the model. We basically assume that once the rear of the vesicle's velocity is below, just by rounding, what it was before it ruptured, we just assume this time started over again at that point. But what happens physically is that the filaments rupture away, and most likely you end up with nucleation of new filaments from the surface that sort of fill that void, and then they integrate into the network again.
But so one thought is that they're free, so they grow quickly.
Well, that's the point. Where I'm saying they're not free. I mean, they're free. They may
the
be capped.
Ones, the broken ones are.
But they should. They still have. If they're still growing, they're still consuming monomer. So, but they're consuming monomer back here, and they're not slowing down the vesicle from rounding up. You see,
they
may be growing.
They have to. So, in order to slow it down, or rehook, they have to catch up. That network has to.
No, I don't think it rehooks. I think it forms new filaments.
Off the surface.
Yeah. I don't think it catches up ever. I think those are just left behind. And that will show up clearly in the saltatory motion here in a second. Okay, so how does this compare to the, here's the experimental trajectory. Here's the this trajectory. Here's the with the close to rigid network. Here's this. The only fitted constant here is the one that sets the time scale. And that is, we didn't know what the monomer concentration was in the experiment. It was in an extract. But this was based on about 1.25 micromolar propylenactin in the extract, which is fairly reasonable. But the length scale here matches up. There's no time consideration there. It's a quasi-static calculation. So it's just how far does it go before it reaches that stress before it rounds up again. And it matches up pretty nicely. So the shape qualitatively looks very good. Quantitatively, it matches up nicely and reasonable for this axis as well. I showed this. That result before I accounted for the elasticity of the network at one point, and I was challenged. I said, well, wait a minute. It doesn't always happen that it oscillates. Sometimes it doesn't oscillate. So how can your model account for that? And this is the case. This is from Ghirardini's paper, Julie Tiro's group. Here's, again, the ACT-A on the surface of the vesicle. Here, and you can see that it's fairly smooth, but also you see that it doesn't quite round up. It doesn't distend quite as much either. So how can you account for the differences? Well, that's where the elastic modulus of the tail comes into play. So we assume 50 kilopascals here, 5 here. There's a big difference in the dynamics. It never reaches this stress to a point where basically the deformation can dissipate those stresses as it's moving forward. It never reaches that critical stress. And so here's a plot of this distance between rounding as a function of the tail modulus, and you see it goes asymptotically to a value of about 5 here, but if it's below about 9 kilopascals in the simulation, then it never rounds up again. So it just reaches a steady state. Okay, so just to show you the difference between those two, here's the other one. Here's this one. Okay, so here's the deformation of it as it's growing. It reaches a steady state. So it's deformed, but it never deformed so much, and that's reflected in what happens in the experiments. Okay, so if it's a hard particle, I'm almost done. If it's a hard particle, what's actually happening?
The experiments have a way of knowing what the modulus of the tail.
Yeah, actually, it's been estimated, but again by bending the Listeria tail, and it's on the order of about 10 kilopascals. So
can you actually tell if the experiments that oscillate or don't have different moduli?
Well, only I can kind of qualitatively tell in the case that if you compare this tail to this tail, and for some reason in Tiro's group, it always seems like the tails dissipate more rapidly in these Xenopus extracts. This was a brain extract, which in our experience, the tails don't dissipate. So it may be that it has something to do with the network properties due to maybe ADF or something, a depolymerization factor. But to actually know just by looking at it or try to measure it. We have in mind some ways that we can do that using a micropipette, but we haven't been second. Not in these vesicles, so you don't see that so much, but in the hard particles you do, and there's an explanation for that. Okay, so I'll skip ahead to that. So here, so what happens when it is a hard particle? Well, in this case, the vesicle can't deform due to the different elongation rate. So what's going to happen? Well, the filaments themselves in the network can deform. So they can still grow at the same rate here in here. I'm sorry. The surface can move forward at the same rate here and here, yet these filaments can grow more slowly than these filaments because they're at different angles. So what that should result in is a higher density, and that's what we believe is appearing here in these bands that appear behind the vesicle. So in fact, a quantitative study was done from Cecile Sykes that found that below about 2.5 microns in diameter, these bands would never appear, and above that, they appear to be fairly constant in the thickness. Okay, so how can that be explained? Well, in a really simple model, this is a listeria doing a similar, this is a mutant that has an alteration in the act A that causes this sort of popping motion, which is similar. Okay, in the simple model, it just assumed that the stress buildup was proportional to the concentration difference between the inside and the outside. Okay, then we can estimate what the band thickness is and show that it's proportional to the concentration on the inside divided by the concentration on the outside, a difference. Plotting this versus radius, okay, as for small radii, it becomes unbounded, which means that you don't see any banding. At larger radius, it seems to go asymptotically to a constant value, which explains that nicely. So the saltatory motion, we believe, is just a result of diffusion limitations and the stresses up. Okay, and also there's a lot of other evidence that, okay, that in the saltatory motion, what happens, why it goes faster, the stresses build up, it detaches the filaments, it has fewer filaments, it can proceed faster for a period of time, it slows down again. Same idea. Okay, this correlation, inverse correlation between tail density of listeria and velocity appeared in many different papers. And this could be very nicely explained simply by increasing the number of filaments that are consuming monomer, it's going to slow the system down. In fact, even a system like this, where ARC23 was flushed out of the system in the new solution without ARC23, you reduce the number of filament ends that branch off and are just consuming monomers, the bacterium actually accelerated in the absence of ARC23. So there's plenty of evidence that the more filaments you have, it doesn't help you go faster. It actually slows you down because you're just consuming more monomer. Okay, how to voice? This question just came up. Another consequence, if you have high tension here, okay, compressive forces here, well, if you break these off, let's say that the system can't recover, that you remove the surface proteins that are necessary for a new filament formation or any filaments that do form, maybe they just come off so quickly under tension, you'd expect a void to be created. And we've actually started a model that shows us you can reach a steady state where you just have a void in the center, and these are growing more close to the same rate, so they can continue forward at a steady state. This appears in vesicles, and it shows up often in listeria as well. So you have a tight network here and a void appearing in the middle. So we believe that, in addition to the fact that there's filaments growing on the side that tend to get wrapped around the side, but part of that may be due to the limitation. Okay, so let me just wrap it up here. Okay, so this idea of a process of in-tracking proteins governing elongation explains many of these different phenomena, which really challenge any idea of how these filaments are elongating. Okay, the monomer size sets and small fluctuations and helical paths of listeria. Okay, where the energy is coming from for the substantial force generation, the teardrop shapes and why Act A and the BCA peptide co-localize with the filaments on these surfaces. The oscillations and stress-independent speed. Oh, that was a major point. Okay, when the vesicles, the stress, as they're distending, the stress is increasing, right? Until it reaches the critical point. The speed doesn't increase at all during that period of time. It remains constant. So any model would have to explain how you can increase stress up to about 10 piconewtons per filament of average over the total filament without actually increasing the speed at all of the surface. Okay, so that's a challenge. I hope we can explain that. These tail voids, saltatory motion, motility of flat particles, thanks to Jim's group. the role, the location of the enobasm and Wasson formans, the role of profilin as this polymerization cofactor, and also the protection from capping protein, which brings to this last slide, is here's the paradigm that we've been pushing, if you will. So Philip, free ends, if they're just in the cell, they'll be capped by capping protein. Okay? This capping protein in the cytoplasm, the lifetime of free end is very short, caps very tightly. Okay, but if the cell produces a free end that needs to do something, okay, it controls its elongation by an intracting protein. Okay, and here's it either can be actually coupled to a surface to do some work, or it can simply be in solution to fill a void, for example. But in either case, this protects the ends from capping until it's turned off by phosphorylation, for example, allows it to be free and then be capped in that case. So that's the idea. Rather than having lots of free filament ends doing things and generating work, we offer this as an alternative point of view.